Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, William Penn and the founding of Pennsylvania, Harry Clarke and the artistic visions of the new Irish state, the story of why Irish country houses, the so-called big houses, were viewed as white elephants after independence, how an angry Irishman became the hero of Delhi, and to end the show, we'll look at a century of parliamentary democracy in Ireland and some of the Irish men and women who have served in our Oireachtas over that time. Last week, we looked at the history of the iconic film Taxi Driver and we debated its impact on cinema and society. And if you want to listen back to this show or any of our older shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or go directly to iTunes. We begin, though, with the story of the founding of Pennsylvania and the pivotal role of William Penn. On the 4th of March, 1681, King Charles II granted William Penn a charter for a new American colony. Pennsylvania was to be, in its founder's words, a bold, holy experiment in religious freedom and toleration, a haven for those fleeing persecution in an increasingly intolerant England and across Europe. An activist, political theorist, and the proprietor of his own colony, Penn would become a household name in the New World, despite spending just 4 years on American soil. And the story has been told brilliantly in a new book by Andrew Orr Murphy. It's called William Penn, A Life. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs £25 sterling, so about €30. And Andrew, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be with you.
A very intriguing thing I read at the end of the book was that President Ronald Reagan in, I think, 1984 gave honorary citizenship to William Penn. And this was something that I think is done very rarely, but it shows just in what high regard Penn was held.
Yes, well, it's a fantastic story. It's much of the citizenship request and much of the work that went into that was due to some very energetic and committed folks in Philadelphia who really wanted to keep Penn's memory alive and to really sort of reiterate how important he was to the American tradition of religious liberty. But you're right. It's a very there's Marquis de Lafayette. There's, I believe, Winston Churchill, a handful of others. But it's an unusual sort of it's unusual, especially because Penn died 50 years before the American Revolution even happened.
We normally associate Penn with America and with Pennsylvania. But another thing that surprised me in the book was that he actually had very close connections with Ireland, and it played a very important role in shaping his whole life.
Absolutely. His father was a famous naval commander. And as a result of his service on the parliamentary side in the Civil War, received about 12,000 acres of Irish land. This is the part of the story that is a bit morally complex from my own perspective and many of your listeners, perhaps. But he was granted the Castle of Macroom, where the family lived for 4 or 5 years in the 1650s, where he first encountered a Quaker preacher. And then in the 1660s, he took two extended trips to Ireland, which were absolutely crucial to his development. In 1667, in Cork, is when he became a Quaker, which was a really transformational, really transcendent spiritual experience. Had his first imprisonment for the sake of conscience there as well. And he was always in Ireland. He was mixing the business of working on his father's behalf as an English landlord, negotiating rents and agreements with tenants, and also at the same time, as in his later visits, with a member of a persecuted religious sect.
Talk to me about the founding of Pennsylvania, because I thought that Penn had spent most of his life there, and because he's so closely associated with the colony and he's so intimately connected with it, but yet it was only twice he was there, for two visits of 2 years each. So although he looms large in the story of Pennsylvania, it was only for a small part of his own life.
Absolutely. I mean, his name is ubiquitous over here, especially around Philadelphia, not surprisingly. And by all accounts, when he first traveled to America in 1682, when he came to set up the colony, he had aspirations to make himself a permanent resident and spend the rest of his life there if he could convince his family to come with him. But as is often the case, I think sort of utopian aspirations are one thing, and the sort of the nitty-gritty details of running a place are another. And so he was really only here a couple of years before he had to return to London due to a border dispute with his southern neighbor, Lord Baltimore. He actually won that case, which was tried in London, and he could have returned at that point. But at that point, his father's old friend James had become King James II, recruited Penn into James's grand experiment to try to bring liberty of conscience to England. And the two really hit it off. They became quite close, not simply advisors, I think, but friends. Both of them were members of marginalized religious groups, and Penn in some ways saw in James the possibility of liberty of conscience in England, which is what he had been working for most of his adult life before Pennsylvania, the opportunity came along. So he ended up staying for 15 years, and of course, in 1688, James's whole program came crashing down. Penn spent the next 5 years in jail, on the run, in hiding, under surveillance, and really only rehabilitated his public image later in the 1690s. And so it wasn't until 1699 that he returned to Pennsylvania. And it was a bit of an ill-fated return. The place had changed, as you can imagine, enormously since he had left. The Pennsylvanians had gotten quite used to going about their own business. They had changed the Constitution without asking him while he was gone. And so they were not particularly happy to have him back. And he was not particularly happy with the way things were going. So when he had the opportunity to come back to England in 1701, he did, and he never returned.
How should we view his legacy? Should he be regarded as a champion of religious freedom in both Britain and America? Or is it a little bit more tricky than that?
Well, I think with all historical figures or all human beings, all of us, it's a complicated story. Penn had spent almost the entire decade of 1670s and 1680s sort of intensely committed to religious freedom, undergoing imprisonments and investing a huge amount of his time and his fortune into that cause. It's also the case that on his American estate, Pensbury, he owned several slaves, and this was not something that he considered, as far as we can tell, morally problematic. He was, I mentioned this in the book, a notoriously poor manager of money. He was prone to holding grudges and had a very thin skin. But he also, at the same time, had sort of really grand aspirations had a vision for what a society could look like if people were able to commit themselves to working together for the common good, despite the fact that they might have deep, deep disagreements on really important things like religion. So I find him to be a absolutely fascinating character. But like any of us, he's a complicated person with lots of parts that don't always fit together.
Well, Andrew, I think your book brings him back to life and does so absolutely brilliantly. It's called William Penn, A Life. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs £25 sterling, so about €30. The author, Andrew Orr Murphy. And Andrew, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me. It's been my pleasure.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History with me, Patrick Gagan. The work and career of the celebrated artist Harry Clarke is inextricably linked to the complex nature of early 20th century Irish culture and of modernism. A brilliant new book examines the complex relationship between visual art and literature that lies at the heart of Clarke's contribution to post-independence society in Ireland. It's called Harry Clarke and Artistic Visions of the New Irish State. It's published in paperback by Irish Academic Press and costs €29.95. The editors are Angela Griffith, Marguerite Helmers and Roisin Kennedy. And Angela, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you so much, Patrick. It's great to be here.
Well, where will we begin? We might begin with the fact that I suppose Clarke himself as an artist and an individual, what's his vision and why was it at odds with the new state?
I think what's very interesting, and this is one of the things that we wanted to look at with this book, is where exactly we place Clarke and where we place Harry Clarke. He's living in this incredible period of change in Ireland. And of course, leading in the decades up to when he suppose he first comes into public recognition, let's say around the mid-1910s. So he's really in this period of change, in this period of rebellion, and he's trying to find his place within that. He's also, of course, caught up in what is the Irish culture revival. So one of the things, I suppose, what has happened and what has happened with a lot of Irish artists is that they tend to be just seen within this bubble that is the Irish revival. But I think one of the things we wanted to put forth is that he's not just an insular looking artist, but in fact, he's very aware of what's going on in Europe. He's engaging with what's going on in Europe in terms of modernism, particularly the symbolist movement. So therefore, I suppose what we find is that he's somebody trying to bridge both worlds, the modern world, which is European and international, on his focus, and then what we see with Clark also, who's very aware of what's happening in terms of Ireland, in terms of change, and he's engaging with that, and he's becoming one of the leading figures in terms of visual culture in Ireland at that time because of major projects.
And he's part of an impressive arts network, you know.
Absolutely.
People like W.B. Yeats and George
much.
Russell and Hugh Lane and so on.
Yeah.
And do you think, though, that his vision of Ireland then after independence is connected to that view of the wider world, that he doesn't want Ireland cut off? He wants to be engaging with this world.
Absolutely. There's no question about that at all. In fact, what we do know, and it's referred to in one of the essays in the book, is the fact that he actually had ambitions perhaps to go and live and work in London, not just be focused in Dublin. And so we know that about him. But when you look at his work, it's particularly when you look at his work, when you look at his illustrations in particular, there is no question. I suppose if you looked at Irishness at that time, a lot of artists were maybe doing, in arts and crafts, they were looking at art such as maybe linking back to the Book of Kells or trying to revive that in some way. He takes that, but he moves way on forward from that. So we see things like references to film, new film in his work. Like the horror film Nosferatu from 1922 ends up being on the cover, a similar figure to a book that's published by Patrick Abercrombie, which was a plan for a new Dublin in the 1920s after, I suppose, the rebellion of the 1916. So this new vision of Ireland, he puts this figure that is sort of representing the past, and it's absolutely a quotation from this modern German film. So therefore, this is somebody who's very aware of what's going on. So he's not finding himself pigeonholed in any way.
And not just film, it's ballet as well.
Oh,
it's new technologies, it's science. He's very much in tune with what's going on around the world.
Very, very much so. And I suppose one of the things we tend to forget about is that he is reading, and despite what, you know, I say, sometimes people think that the revival was insular looking. It wasn't. There's publications coming from Europe, there's publications coming from Britain. He's reading these scientific journals about looking at botany, and he starts quoting sort of images that are from microscopic details, or as you say, from the Ballet Russe, where he's looking at these wonderful exotic costumes that are being presented in London, and all of a sudden they find their way into his stained glass, which absolutely is so new and fresh and different.
How was this all received by the public then at the time?
Yeah, that's very interesting. Some of the criticisms at the time, there's this wonderful quotation one of them gives, that Harry Clarke could make a daisy look corrupt, which I thought was an incredible quote. But at the same time, I think what happens is that he starts to get recognition for his work and his expertise and his skills when he starts getting recognised at international exhibitions and local exhibitions. And I think what happens at the time is people are very happy to take this new young artist who's making waves abroad and is being recognised. And they're saying, well, he's Irish, let's celebrate him and so forth. So he keeps getting commissions. He gets commissions from the Catholic Church, from the Church of Ireland. He's getting commissions from companies such as Jameson, which, of course, was associated with unionism. And yet at the same time, then he's doing covers for the Dublin Magazine, which, of course, is representing the best of Irish literature at that time. What I find fascinating is his ability to draw in all these different strands of Irish society and talk to them and engage with them and visualise for them, which is really amazing.
So what was his legacy? And is there a sense that maybe he's been too narrowly remembered as the artist of great stained glass windows, but not as a master craftsman and not as someone who had this international dimension and a much broader range?
Yeah, I think for a long time, of course, because of the very nature of buildings, he was known for his stained glass. And of course, the stained glass very often tends to be in sacred spaces, which are churches. So that tended to see him a little bit pigeonholed, and also because of the legacy of his studio, which continued after his death. But what ended up happening to him, I suppose, in one sense as well, is that while everybody, say, towards the 50s and 60s started to embrace modernism, say, looking at Minnie Jellett or Louis Labrocki, he didn't quite fit in there. So he tended to be sort of forgotten a little bit until the great work of Nicola Gordon Bowe, when she revived, brought an exhibition of his work in the late 70s to the Douglas Hyde, and then wrote the book in the late 80s. And he started to be re-evaluated from then on. But I think what we were anxious to do with this book is not just to focus on him, the man, but the wider cultural context in which he found himself in.
What I loved about the book is that it brings together leading experts from a range of fields. It's
yes.
truly multi-interdisciplinary. Yeah. You have Jarlath Killeen and experts from English literature.
Absolutely.
And it's all this range of experts.
Yeah, that was very important for us as well. And of course, it is, I suppose, an academic book, but at the same time, and that's why we wanted to engage with lots of different voices and different perspectives. Jarlath's essay, looking at, you know, from the point of view of gender, is really wonderful and collaborative. With those sorts of people, and including our colleagues from the States, that was important for their perspectives on him, and maybe not to have the sort of cultural baggage that maybe some of us from Ireland might have had. So they give us totally new perspectives, and we were anxious to do that.
Okay, well, it's a brilliant book, and I think it will get a good readership with our listeners, because whenever we've covered Harry Clarke, there's always been a great reaction. It's Harry Clarke and Artistic Visions of the New Irish State. It's published in paperback by Irish Academic Press and costs €29.95. The editors are Angela Griffith, Marguerite Helmers and Roisin Kennedy. And Angela, thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History. On News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History with me, Patrick Gagan. Grand, awe-inspiring and beautiful, the Big House is widely viewed as a jewel in the Irish landscape today. Despite this, the relationship between the country house and the state has long been complex and nuanced. From the 1920s to the 1970s, hundreds of former landlords' residences, often seen as symbols of British oppression, were sold on, demolished, or simply abandoned to ruin. And the story has now been told in a brilliant new book, White Elephants, The Country House and the State in Independent Ireland, 1922 to 1973. It's published in hardback by UCD Press and costs €40. And I'm delighted to welcome its author, Emer Crook, to the show tonight. Emer, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Patrick.
Can we begin with the title of White Elephants? Why did you hit upon that for telling the story of the country house?
So white elephants traditionally is a term used to describe extravagant gifts, but that are just ruinous to maintain. And the term comes up over and over again in Oireachtas debates, in government files, when politicians are describing historic country houses. So really the whole point was that these were beautiful, magnificent buildings. But in the period under study from the 20s to the 70s, maintaining them, preserving them, restoring them was a huge financial burden. So even, for example, when they were gifted freely to the state, the expense of upkeep would have been enormous. And that's where the title came from.
And do you think there was any element that they were hostile to these country houses because of their because of what they had been used for, because of the historical feelings about them, that maybe there was a certain amount of bitterness or resentment, or was it purely the cost of the upkeep?
Yeah, so the reason I actually began this study is because I felt that there was, you know, in popular perception, there was this sense that these houses were ruined and, you know, destroyed throughout the Irish countryside because of overtly antagonistic policies of Irish governments. And when I looked into it, a study had never really been done to ascertain if this was the case. And certainly, I mean, in the book, the debate is complex in government departments. There's definitely prejudice in some quarters. For example, the Secretary General of the Department of Finance, J.J. McElligott, when describing Rusborough House, said, look, there's nothing particularly or distinctively Irish about this house, so why would an Irish government preserve it? So there's that attitude throughout government files. But to be honest, the final decision was almost universally made on economic grounds, financial grounds. So pragmatism rather than open antagonism was the defining feature of the debates.
Let's talk about some of the houses. Rusborough House, for example, I think the state refused that as a gift.
Absolutely, yeah. It was offered in 1929 as a gift to the state. And actually, I mean, there was good consideration of it. A number of senior officials in government, including the president of the executive council, undertook a number of visits to Rusborough House. They were, you know, in awe of its beauty and so on. But actually, in the end, it was declined. But really, I mean, when you look at the cost involved compared to what the OPW, for example, spent on national monuments, you know, the average at that time was £2,800 a year on national monuments. Rusborough would have cost, you know, over double that, they estimated, in just upkeep. So in the end, on economic grounds, they refused it. But interestingly also, you know, features of the time came into it. For example, they talk about Rusborough being way too far from Dublin to be able to attract any visitors. So at the time, over 20 miles from Dublin was this, of course, great distance, given that, you know, so many of the population didn't have much leisure time. There wasn't international tourism. People maybe didn't have cars or second cars. So they just thought it was too far out to really justify the spend of public money on the property.
And of course, they weren't all ascendancy houses either, because you have significant estates like, for example, Derrynane.
Yeah, and the case of Derrynane is, they're always interesting ones because there's the added element of the historical character attached to it. So, you know, in this time, the state do undertake to make Avondale House, for example, into a museum. There's great debate over Derrynane because, you know, they really don't want to see it going to ruin because of its associations, of course, with Daniel O'Connell. But then, I mean, when the chairman of the OPW, Joseph Connolly, is talking about Cool Park and debates about other such houses, he criticised a school of thought that any house should be preserved because anyone ever wrote a play or a poem there.
Do you think there was a certain lack of vision, or was it just that they perhaps didn't realise that there would be a booming tourism industry in the future that they would be able to benefit from keeping and preserving some of these houses?
Yeah, I think that's a question that remains relevant today. So, I mean, even in the 1970s, Kevin Boland, a minister at the time, made a speech in the Dáil saying that while he was minister, as long as the people's, you know, demands for sanitation and housing were met, then he wouldn't, you know, spend a penny on the preservation of historic properties. So it's a debate that rages on. Certainly throughout this period, there's a question over whether it would have been publicly justifiable to spend large amounts of money on these houses. There was an emigration crisis in the 1950s. In the 20s, 30s, and even up to the early 40s, people were living in slum tenements in Dublin. So there was a question of whether you could justifiably allow even rates, exemptions from rates and taxes for these houses. That being said, I think we do expect on the state's behalf that there's some foresight shown. But certainly, I mean, in Ireland, there was never, probably because of historical associations as well, a great domestic interest in these houses in the way that there was in the UK.
Charles Haughey is a politician who features in the book. Did he have a vision for these country houses?
His part is interesting. It comes up in the discussion around Bishop's Court, which is a case study examined here. It's a big house in Strathfann that was offered as a gift to the state in the late 1950s, early 1960s. And the debate rages on for a long time. And in the middle of it, Charles Haughey is involved as finance minister. Now, as the case rumbles on, it gets more complex and the owners put more and more demands on the gift. But there is an unusual part where discussions are taking place between Haughey as Minister for Finance and the house owners. And really, there's just no records of those discussions, which is a little unusual. And it'd be great to see what happened there. We do know very soon after he purchased Abbeville and Conseely, which is an old historic house and an association with Anglo-Irish history and a stud farm and so on, which was very similar to Bishop's Court. But it's difficult to tell because, unfortunately, those records weren't in the archives when I looked.
Very interesting. And, of course, this is something that still goes on because it was only in recent decades that Farmley was purchased by the government.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point because in 1999, Farmley's purchased for £29 million. And that, you know, there's no major public outcry about this. Whereas in earlier decades, of course, you know, that kind of sum being expended, again and again, government files, we see them worried about the public's reaction. Whereas in 1999, we're in the throes of the Celtic Tiger. And therefore, the economic situation is, of course, influential in this debate. And Farmley could be purchased then and is used as a guest house for the state today.
And do you think that we lost anything that should have been preserved, but it was just seen as a white elephant and wasn't purchased?
Yeah, there's sad cases. You know, there's beautiful buildings, beautiful architecture. When Dunsandel and its contents are kind of sold off, you see marble fireplaces going for nothing and great stucco work. There's a fairy tale Shanbally Castle, which was destroyed. It's a great loss, and particularly in rural communities where perhaps now, if there had been foresight, they might be, you know, of amenity or tourism value to rural communities. But again, the question of economics comes up, and they probably couldn't have preserved a huge number of them, but certainly it's a shame that so many were lost.
Okay, well, Emer, congratulations on the book. It's called White Elephants, The Country House and the State in Independent Ireland, 1922 to 1973. It's published in hardback by UCD Press and costs €40. The author, Emer Crook. And Emer, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks, Patrick. It's my pleasure.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Born in Dublin, Lieutenant General John Nicholson died in the thick of battle as the British army he was leading stormed the ancient city of Delhi in September 1857. He was only 34 years old. However, his legacy and his legend as the hero of Delhi far outlived him, and the story has now been told in a brilliant new book, Nicholson: How an Angry Irishman Became the Hero of Delhi. It's published in paperback by the History Press and costs €22. The author is Donald P. McCracken, and Donald, you're very welcome back to the show.
Well, it's nice to be on, Patrick. Nice to speak to you again.
Tell us about John Nicholson, because he died at the age of 34, but as you show in the book, he actually had, he saw an awful lot of military action in that lifetime.
He did, and he's unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on the way you look at it, got a pretty bad reputation. He was described by a modern author as an imperial psychopath, and the trend nowadays is to look at him as a sort of taciturn Ulsterman, brutal, unstable, anti-Indian, a racist, someone who is very violent, a disciplinarian. I've tried to sort of change the picture a little bit and give a little bit of balance to it in the book.
And sorry, what's interesting is that that's very different from the image and the reputation he had after his death, when he was known as the hero of Delhi and when he inspired children who read stories of his exploits and he encouraged others to join the army, that there has been a huge shift in how he was and how he has been perceived.
Indeed. And I think there needs to be a little bit of balance. The truth is that his memory has been hijacked not once but twice. It was hijacked a generation after he died in the 1880s and the 1890s by the imperial jingoes, and became a sort of symbolic imperial inspiration, as you said, sort of children's books being written about him, and the great sort of Christian muscular hero. Of course, 100 years later, you have a complete reaction against all that, with the anti-colonial colonialism dominating the scene. So a hero becomes a villain. Basically, and my task was to try and work out, well, what was the truth between these two?
The subtitle of the book mentions that he was an angry Irishman. How angry was he, and how Irish did he consider himself to be?
Well, two things there. One, how angry was he? He was very angry. He had problems, as they say nowadays. He had a dreadful childhood. His father died when he was young. His mother was a religious fixated Puritan who had seven children to bring up in genteel poverty in Donnybrook, and then Delgany, and finally in Lisburn. And at 16 years of age, he was shunted across the world to Bengal alone, basically as a boy soldier. And he had a dreadful time in Afghanistan, as all foreign armies go into Afghanistan tend to have. He was imprisoned in appalling conditions. And then when he did get out, coming down the Khyber Pass, he found the mutilated body of his own brother, Alex. So he became intensely shy and introverted, socially inept in many respects, completely lacking in diplomacy, and prone to these violent outbursts of rage and eccentric behavior. I think one thing that I have unearthed is one of the reasons for that was not only his background, but also the medication that he took, because he took that all-cure Victorian blue pill, as they called it then, not the blue pill of today, that Abraham Lincoln also took. And it was a mixture of licorice and honey and marshmallow, and then added to it was one-third of the pill of the dose was mercury, pure mercury. And then to that, for his liver complaint, because he had liver problems, he spooned hydrochloric acid down his throat, so it's no wonder that he was bad tempered.
And as for his Irishness,
As for his Irishness, he was very Irish. He spoke he spoke with an Anglo-Irish accent. He always referred to himself as an Irishman. He mixed with fellow Irishmen. The Punjab was full of Irish officers in the East India Company Army, in particular. Henry Lawrence of Derry, Robert Montgomery of Moville, Captain Dermot Daly of Galway, and the great engineer Alexander Taylor of Dublin. And his own adjutant was a young fellow called Freddie Roberts, who later became the famous Field Marshal General from Waterford. He regarded himself as being Irish, but he wasn't particularly pious. He wasn't sort of a Bible-thumping fanatic. And in fact, in one time, he actually criticized Christian missionaries in India. And he didn't involve himself in Irish politics. His letters home are actually, strangely enough, for someone with such a bad reputation, or relatively normal. He once only alludes to O'Connell and basically says to his mother, "Oh, I'm very pleased you're not in any area where there's going to be any trouble," which was fair enough. And he came home once. He came home in 1852 on furlough, and there was a great banquet held in the market house in Lisburn for him. And he sat under a great banner written in Irish, and that didn't offend him. He didn't find anything particularly wrong with that. So in his lifetime in Ireland, he was greatly respected. It's only been later that question marks have been risen.
Some have called him the finest army frontline British field commander of the Victorian era. Does he deserve that reputation?
Yes, I think he does. I think that there are question marks over the question of brutality. Look, it was time of war. It was an impossible situation. By the way, his brutality wasn't a personal brutality, if I can make the distinction. He didn't sort of fight in the mess and brawls and that sort of brutality. It was the institutional brutality of the military. It was things like, well, he advocated the flaying of prisoners, but that was in a private letter, and I think he was just having a rant. He executed prisoners. He shot prisoners. Well, of course, the other side shot prisoners too. But things that nowadays would be unacceptable in a military situation, in those days, you know, he got away with it. Although, strangely enough, when he was in the Sikh War, the Anglo-Sikh War, he was much less draconian as regards the prisoners. On one occasion, he let them all go home to their homes, the captured prisoners, because he had this thing about mutiny, that the only punishment for mutiny was execution. However, as a military commander, of course, he was a frontiersman. He was up on the frontier, and life was rough and tough up there. When the mutiny or the Great Rebellion broke out in May 1857, he was put eventually in command of the Punjab military column, about 2,000 men, who marched around the Punjab, basically disarming suspect Bengal army regiments and generally intimidating the region into submission, and or at least not into revolt. He was also, of course, an administrator and a soldier, and his period of administration was very colourful. He had a great spy network which he ran. I suppose nowadays they'd call it military intelligence. Ironically, he was fascinated about modern weaponry and quarrelled with the British War Office over them not adopting the new Prussian needle gun. And yet back home in the Punjab, it was sort of semi-medieval type warfare. He himself fought and won three battles. And on each occasion, you know, he would dismount and he would fight alongside his men using a sabre.
Well, Donald, many thanks for joining me tonight and for bringing me the story of how an angry Irishman became the hero of Delhi. And that's the subtitle of the book, Nicholson. It's published in paperback by the History Press. It costs €22. And Donald P. McCracken, the author, rejoining me 10 years after we had him on talking about his book, Inspector Malin, about the Assistant Commissioner of the Dublin Metropolitan Police. Donald, congratulations on the new book.
Well, thank you. thank you very much, and thank you for having me. I just say one other thing about Nicholson, and that was I've never met a soldier who didn't like Nicholson, and I've never met an academic who did like Nicholson, which I suppose says something about something.
That says an awful lot about both academia and the military. Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Donal, and thanks a million for joining us about the book. We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Our state, born in revolution and baptised in civil war, is one of the few states established in the aftermath of the First World War to have survived as a parliamentary democracy to the present. A new book, Irish Parliamentarians, is a directory of the 1,780 men and women who have been TDs or senators since the first meeting of Dáil Éireann in January 1919. It profiles the founders of modern Irish democracy and their successors, with details of their families, education and careers inside and outside of politics. It's called Irish Parliamentarians, Deputies and Senators, 1918 to 2018. It's published in hardback by the Institute of Public Administration and costs €60. The author is Anthony White. And Anthony, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
First of all, I think it's an absolutely brilliant book because it will be an incredible resource to scholars, to historians, to people who are interested in politics, both now and in the years ahead, because it is a guide to all the people who have served in our Oireachtas since the very beginning. And it's extraordinary when you then start categorising the people, the men and women, to see the trends. And that's something you've also been very interested in doing.
Yeah, well, what surprised me, actually, in looking at, say, the occupations of the people who have, in the very early Dáil, the very first and the second Dáil, the biggest single category, believe it or not, was journalists. But that did not replicate itself afterwards. In the 100 years, far and away the biggest group have been farmers.
There is a belief, is it a myth or is it true, that lawyers and teachers are also very prominent?
The next biggest group would be teachers. And they're very sizable. And if you add in academics then as well, it's certainly far and away the second biggest group. After that comes the lawyers. There's about 150 of them. I mean, the farmers were something like 350. The teachers and the academics came to about 230.
And why do you think that is? Is it because the professions give you a kind of a job security that allows you to run for election, or is there something else there?
Well, I think in terms of lawyers, the whole business, if you like, I mean, legislation is the question of where the laws are made, and inevitably lawyers have an interest in that. So that's that. I mean, in every society, you'll find the lawyers figure quite highly. So they were the third in terms of the group. Surprisingly, the next biggest group were actually auctioneers, which that came as a real surprise to me. There were nearly 100 of them there. Now, there was a certain amount of double counting because a lot of the farmers actually doubled up as auctioneers as well.
I think from the figures that you compiled, I think there were 1,302 TDs, 478 senators, and then 318 TDs who also served time as senators. Only 189 of the total figure were women. So it shows just how much of an imbalance there has been over the century.
Oh, yes. And I mean, well, certainly in the early years, this was very much a man's game. And in fact, if you look at it in the first 50 years, so say up to 1968, I think of those 189, only about one-fifth of them were women. I think it was something like less than 30. And of that lot, the majority of them, about 80% of them, were either the widows of male TDs or daughters of male TDs, or else they were relatives of people who'd fought in the War of Independence. Very few other women. Now that has very much changed in the last 50 years, and I mean it's going to change again because, as you know, there's now a quota that parties are supposed to meet if they want to get financial support. They've got 30% at the last election, and it's up to 40% in 2023. And I mean, the actual representation from women, the idea, I mean, there was a certain kind of thing when a TD died in the early years, well, put up the widow was almost the thing to do. Well, that simply doesn't apply anymore. And in fact, in the last election, there were 19 new women TDs, and only one of them had any relationship with anybody who was currently or had previously served in the Dáil. So in terms of candidate selection, that doesn't apply any longer.
Continuing with the theme of family connections, there is that perception or sense that Ireland has always had a lot of political dynasties, fathers passing it on seats to their children. And we can think of some people who went on to very distinguished careers, like, for example, Enda Kenny, who inherited his seat, well, ran for election and won the seat when his father died. Is that as prevalent as we think?
It's not. And nowadays it's even less prevalent, just as was the case with female TDs overall. The business of family has far less impact on candidate selection nowadays, and it was commoner before. But in fact, if you, whatever way you pick it, less than a quarter of the people, if you add together all the people, either fathers, sons, grandparents, whoever, you'll find that less than a quarter of the people who've been in the Dáil and the Senate were related to each other. So I don't think the evidence is there that it is something that is absolutely full of nepotism and family connections and dynasties. In any case, they have to get elected. And, that kind of thing is certainly likely to have less and less appeal nowadays.
What I love about the book is that when it has the entry on the person, it will list the elections they ran in and whether they won or lost. And it's interesting that you might have someone who maybe won five elections in a row but then lost the sixth one, and then maybe they retire from politics, and some who maybe a career which involves some terms in the Seanad, and then they get re-elected to the Dáil, and it's maybe a bit back and forth. It's harder to go back into politics, it seems, if you've been out for a time.
Oh yeah. And I mean, it's really a very insecure existence. I mean, I reckon that only 28% of all that, you mentioned the number of 1,780 people who've been TDs and senators, I reckon there's only about 28% of them who've never lost an election. And some people have lost a lot of elections. So it's quite an insecure kind of occupation or way of life.
And what do you think has been the biggest influence on people getting elected? Is it being associated with a successful party, but quite a few independents in the book as well?
Yes, though, I mean, there's no question about it. The vast bulk of the TDs have been elected by the two main parties. First of all, Fianna Fáil, and secondly, Fine Gael and its predecessor, Cumann na Gael. And they have effectively dominated Irish politics since 1927. I would reckon, from the second election in 1927. So that's been the surest way of having. There are the odd exception of people who have had a long career as an independent, but they're rare.
What's the age profile? Because it's my sense is that they were a lot younger when we had the first Dáil and the second Dáil, but then it seems that maybe the age profile got higher as time went on.
Oh yeah, I mean, you're right about that. The early years, it was a very, I mean, the War of Independence was conducted by very young men, and the early Dáil, I mean, the vast majority of them in say the second Dáil were under the age of 40. And a very significant number of them were under the age of 30. That changed inevitably. So the last election, for example, the average age of people when they got elected in 2016 was 50. But that's exactly the same roughly as it was in 1957, when I see that election as one of the ones where the old generation were finally beginning to. It was the last time that De Valera ran, the last time Richard Mulcahy ran. And the average age then was at 50. So it would have gone up gradually from around the age of 40. I mean, there were some older people in the first and second Dáil that did bring the average age up a bit. But it was very much at the level of about 40 or early 40s. And it had gone up to about 50. And that's more or less what it's been like ever since.
It's also interesting when you look at the education of the people who are elected, because you look at that as well, and real discrepancies and a real range there as well.
Yeah, well, in the early years, inevitably, a significant number of the people hadn't anything beyond primary education, if indeed they'd even got that far. And so in the first 50 years, you'd find, I mean, I think the number who'd gone to third level was something like 37-38%. There was an about the same had been in secondary education. When you look at the last 50 years, obviously it's changed completely. Those who merely have primary education be less than 4%. About a third of them would have stopped at the end of second level. And, you know, five out of every eight have been to third level in some shape or form. So, but I think one thing that's worth saying is that, I mean, that's really a reflection of the way the society was at the time. One of the things I did in doing this book was looking at what backbenchers as well as ministers said in the time. They were very bright people. They might have finished school at 12 or 13, but regardless, they were very, very intelligent people.
Finally, is there anything that surprised you when you were going through every single man and woman who has represented us in our Oireachtas?
Well, I suppose the thing that probably surprised me most is that the kind of image Irish politicians have popularly is that they're not a particularly bright bunch of people, and that that's not what I discovered from sort of a pretty extensive reading of debates. Now, a lot of these things are not reported because, I mean, as Ted Neilan once complained, we're really talking to ourselves when we're in there. But the standard of some of those debates were extremely high, and it was quite an education doing it. I think that probably more than anything else is what did surprise me in looking at this 1,780 people.
Okay, well, congratulations on the book. It's a book I've used a lot myself, and I think it'll be one of those books that will be used and exhausted by scholars in the years ahead. It's called Irish Parliamentarians, Deputies and Senators, 1918 to 2018. It's published in hardback by the Institute of Public Administration and costs €60. The author is Anthony White. And Anthony, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much indeed.
Well, my thanks to Anthony White for joining me tonight. The book is called Irish Parliamentarians, Deputies and Senators, 1918 to 2018. It's published in hardback by the Institute of Public Administration and costs €60. And I'm afraid that brings us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cahill, my producer, and Chris Bent on sound. Next weekend for the bank holiday, we are going to be playing you one of my favourite shows about a writer whose statue stands at the front gate of Trinity College Dublin, but who we know very little about really, I suppose, and that is Oliver Goldsmith. Well, we're going to be reclaiming him in next week's show, and then in 2 weeks' time we're going to be down in Kilkenny for our live outside broadcast. So join us next week and the week after on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.
Talking History on News Talk.